From the Sky News Centre at 5, the former Chief of Defence Staff, Lord Guthrie, has accused the government of dithering over whether to reinforce our troops in Afghanistan. Earlier, the Prime Minister defended the war, saying it was one we must not walk away from. President Obama is considering whether to send an extra 40,000 troops. America's head of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, says there must be a strong U.S. presence.
We do in part because of the link between al-Qaeda and the safety of the people of the United States within the United States, and that is a top priority for the president.
The U.S. military has ordered bases across America to tighten security after 13 people were shot dead. 30 others were wounded at the Fort Hood base in Texas. Muslim Army psychiatrist Major Nidal Malik Hassan is suspected of carrying out the attack. He was shot four times by security police and is in a stable condition as investigators wait to speak to him. President Obama has paid tribute to the victims.
I've ordered the flags at the White House and other federal buildings to be flown at half staff. This is a modest tribute to those who lost their lives, even as many were preparing to risk their lives for their country.
A former army sergeant who admitted supplying guns to gangland criminals has been jailed for 18 years. Paul Alexander was arrested after his DNA was found on a weapon during an anti-gun operation following the murder of schoolboy Rhys Jones in Liverpool. He was linked to 28 crime scenes, including a murder. British Airways plans to cut a further 1,200 jobs after reporting its worst ever half-year results. Pre-tax losses to the end of September were £292 million. Chelsea manager Carlo Ancelotti is refusing to think about transfers until January. Looks like the club will be able to sign players after their transfer ban for breaking rules was suspended by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And Miss England Rachel Christie has relinquished her crown after being arrested on suspicion of a nightclub assault in Manchester. Organisers of the competition say the 21-year-old wants to concentrate on clearing her name. That's the latest. I'm Dave Terrace.
93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and our guest in the studio to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Our regular Old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. And Marina Morris will be looking at happiness in the credit crunch. In the second hour from 6, Billy Quain will be shuffling in to tell us what's on for free over the weekend. After that, as promised last week, we take a close look at the work of American filmmaker Alan Frankovich. His films in the 1980s and for the BBC in the 90s are about political warfare and media manipulation by the US Central Intelligence Agency. They suggest the CIA have taken a secret role in terrorist atrocities in some so-called friendly countries such as Italy and Belgium. We'll be discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures averaging 7 degrees Celsius this weekend and a dry and sunny weekend. Cold. Next week, 6 degrees again and a fairly dry week with some rain on Tuesday and Friday with some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of November, averaging around 10 degrees Celsius. That's a little bit warmer. Rainy and windy with a few sunny spells. That was a long-range weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through this week's news. And with us in the studio this week is Mark Weston.
Hello.
Mark, can you tell us whereabouts? Are you actually from Bristol?
No, I'm actually from near Liverpool. We're an Everton fan, so I'm not having a great day. So if no one can mention last night's game, that'll be fantastic.
Well, we don't really do sport on here, actually, so we'll leave that one.
It's all right, from last night, Everton don't look like they do either.
No. And as a Bristol City Councillor, a Conservative, do you have another paid job as well?
Yes, I do. Actually, I work for Ashley Fox. He's a member of the European Parliament.
And what do you do for him?
I'm his political agent for the South West, making sure he gets out and about, communicate with the electorate, and that kind of thing, and handle the policy and casework.
So what does that mean day to day? What are you doing, you know, for him?
Well, it can actually be pretty varied. I mean, it can be anything from communications, arranging visits to, say, Albury site, advising on palm oil, for example. It really can vary depending on what is coming in that day, what legislation is coming in. I mean, Ashley's on the Constitutional Affairs Committee in the European Parliament, so he had an awful lot to say on the Lisbon Treaty, and I imagine we'll probably get to that at some point.
What did he have to say on it then?
He hates it. I mean, the Lisbon Treaty itself, I don't know how my colleagues here feel, it definitely, I believe, should have gone to a referendum, but it's in force now, so I'm afraid we have to live with it and move on and fight to the next battle.
Okay, we will talk about that a little bit later on as well. And what role do you play in the Conservative group on Bristol City Council?
Well, obviously, I'm the councillor for Hembury and Brentry in the north of the city. My principal role is actually planning, and I was on the stadium, which was a little controversial, on Wednesday. So I was there throughout the 4.5 hours that we, you know, chatted about that one. But that planning is my main one.
Now, we were talking to Richard Eddy, the leader of the Conservatives, last week.
Yeah,
and I'm going to ask you the same question. Bristol is either Labour or Liberal. It flip-flops between the two. Why don't the Conservatives ever get a look-in?
If we knew that, we'd probably have a look-in. I mean, I think the last time the Conservatives were in charge was in 1983. I think an awful lot of the problem was the areas that traditionally you would expect to vote Conservative. In the 90s, I'd hardly say we were popular. So they tended to go Lib Dem, and it's cracking those back. But we are making inroads. We are now the official opposition. We did that last year. It's just a slow process. We have to convince people that we're not the stereotype that people for a decade, 2 decades thought that we were.
And, okay, and what committees are you yourself on? You mentioned planning already.
Well, that is it. I'm planning. I mean, it depends. I have a full-time job as well, so I can't go on half a dozen committees. So it is planning, and then you've got all the things that go from that, things like site visits, from agenda conferences, special briefings, training. So it is actually a fairly in-depth discussion. I mean, planning law is fairly convoluted. I don't always agree with
it. And some people will say boring too. But anyway,
I would say
well
boring.
Well done for taking it on. And can you explain the cabinet system? Because this came in a few years ago in Bristol and in other big cities around the country. Can you just explain the cabinet system and let us know whether you're in favour of it or not, whether you think it's made things better for democracy in the city?
I suppose the answer in everything is partly. I mean, the cabinet system is good to an extent. As once you've got a cabinet, the cabinet is responsible for the decisions in the city, which is great because it always means you've got a leadership, you know where you're going, and you've devolved powers to the cabinet, so you don't need a council meeting on every single thing that they make a decision on. The flip side of that is, and I think happens a bit now, is the cabinet can make a decision and only be advised by the council at large. And sometimes you really do want some of the big decisions to actually be debated at council. I mean, the one that went through cabinet recently, actually touching on the stadium, was that the cabinet agreed that the taxpayer would fund an 8 million extension if the bid is successful to the ground. And I think that would mean quite a topic of discussion, should we say, at the council, bearing in mind we are at the bottom of a recession at this point.
So it means that some of the big issues in the city aren't really being discussed in the full council?
No. I mean, I guess it's like if you had any kind of government system, there are pros and cons to it. The advantage is you have clear leadership. The bad thing is, well, actually, you do take out part of the democratic scrutiny that happens. Council can look at what goes on. It can advise on what's going on. But then cabinet, if they're strong enough, if they have a majority, can just choose to ignore council.
Now, I know you've also taken a great interest in the Avon, which has also been very controversial between the Liberals and the Labour group, the Avonmouth biofuel plant. Can you just tell us about what that is and you know, what your thoughts are on it?
Yeah, I mean, this is coming through recently, and I think the Conservative group at large agree with this, that there is a proposed 50 megawatt biofuel plant going to be built, or it's proposed to be built, it's going for planning, up in Avonmouth. The decision's probably going to be next month, maybe even January. And it's highly controversial because biofuels, you know, everyone says, oh, it's a renewable energy, but okay, you cut the rainforest down to do it, you're threatening all those species, you're taking land that was previously growing food to grow biofuel, and then you're shipping it around the world to burn it here. And I just think there are more efficient options to do that don't damage the environment to such a horrendous degree.
But is this something that is actually fits in with planning law when you're deciding whether or not to award planning permission?
Unfortunately, it doesn't. When you're looking at the planning law, you're going to have to just look at the feasibility of, you know, does it need to go there? You can justify need to a point, but it's mainly about does it satisfy criteria? Is it, what kind of land is it on? What kind of transport links is it on? And for a planning reason, it's very hard to object to. But it's not, I think it's something that as a society, I think we really should. It's not the way forward with renewable energy.
Okay, so what is? Because we need it. We need, do need our electricity,
well,
don't we?
Yeah, I mean, the main problem is, and the report happened, that in February this year, I think we were using 64 gigawatts, and this is where we're going to get really geeky, so I'm very sorry about this. Okay, but in 5 or 6 years, we're going to have a 20 gigawatt shortfall. Now, the government spent a decade just prevaricating, quite frankly, sitting on a fence before they actually made a decision. And they've decided now that they're going to go with nuclear energy, which is fair and good enough. I am pro-nuclear. We could probably have a fight about that one later. I don't know. But that's not going to come online until 2020. And we're going to have the shortfall in 2016. Now, there are actually sources out there of renewable energy, which I think you can look at. There's, for example, the Atlantic Array off North Devon, which will be 1.5 gigawatts. And that's a offshore wind farm. And if you think about this, palm oil plant is going to be 50 megawatts and the Atlantic Array is 1.5 gigawatts. You can kind of see the numbers we're going to have to deal with. But I suppose ultimately it's going to have to be more efficient.
So are you one of these people that really doesn't like coal at all? Because Bristol, of course, was a coal mining area, and places like Radstock and South Wales, fantastic reserves still of coal under the ground.
I've got to say I'm not a fan of coal in itself. Depending on where, I mean, where you come down on the green argument, I think coal is heavily polluting, and I'm not for it. But I think one of the problems we have at the moment is the green argument, the green agenda. There are a lot of people out there that are sceptical or don't believe it's to the same hype that is coming forward. And sometimes I just think that the Greens need to ease off a bit and say, well, you know, we need to do things for strategic reasons. Surely it's better for us to be having renewables or nuclear fuel and not relying on foreign imports of oil and gas and things like that. So I think you need to push another argument rather than just carbon all the time.
So the links between the nuclear power industry and the military don't bother you?
No, they don't.
Okay. Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, we've had another dose of printing money, that is what is now called quantitative easing and bailouts this week. What about, can you just tell us about quantitative easing? What is printing money and what's its effect?
Well, quantitative easing, you could just call it monetization of the debt, but that's a bit embarrassing because what it means, you are effectively printing money. I think one of the problems with printing money as it's being done at the moment is we're printing money to give it to the banks to lend it back to us.
If
they lend it back, which of course, being private sector institutions driven by a profit motive, they're unlikely to do because it's not in their interest to do so. So we're chasing our own tail with this business at the moment.
So do you think it was a bit of a waste of time going this week?
No. Once you've got to come to a decision whether you are going to rescue the banking system or not. Austrian economists, the Austrian school of von Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, they would have argued that if banks are bust, you let them go bust.
Creative destruction.
Creative destruction. I think the general consensus, certainly it within the banks and of course within the governments of the Western world, was that that was too destructive a process and that they would have to be rescued. But I think we ought to have looked seriously at the idea of letting them go bust. I mean, let's be free marketeers. We're going to be free marketeers. If the City of London is bust, let it go bust, like South Wales coal mine.
But I mean, much of this has been caused by deregulation, hasn't it? And isn't that one of the main conservative policies, Mark?
Yeah, well, it is deregulation. But the problem is deregulation doesn't mean no regulation. But the regulation you've got does need to be checked. And I think for too long, and I think everyone will say it, no matter which side of the political aisle they're on, too long they were completely unchecked. But one part I think has risen in the last year is the confusion in the banks themselves. The government did bail them out, and you could argue maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. But they bailed them out, then told them they needed to have the same lending, level of lending, as the year before, and told them that they needed greater reserves of capital. Now, they can't do both. So they've tried to do both, they failed, and now we're having to put more money into the system.
Okay, Martin, which should they do? Which is most important?
They need We need to spend money into the economy to prevent a depression or recession. That's what Keynes taught us in the 30s. But it's a very inefficient way to spend money into the economy, to give it to private sector banks who then sit on it and write it off against their toxic
assets.
So why
are they doing this then? Why is the government doing this?
Because we're trying to keep up the fiction that there is a real private banking system. In fact, the private banking system is bankrupt. And that includes the banks that haven't been bailed out, because they're owed money by the banks that have been. So what we've got, what I would argue, and of course this isn't the government's position, I'm just a Labour activist, I would just argue that we ought to actually start rethinking the way in which we provide credit into our economy, full stop. I mean, what's the matter with having a publicly owned credit system?
I think you also need to have another thought, is the level of debt that in our lives we seem to find acceptable. I mean, I think if you go to university now, I mean, I had this, I'm only 29, going grey, but never mind. As you finish university and you're used to a life already built on debt.
Absolutely.
You then go out into the world and you want a car. Well, you'll get a car, but you'll get a car loan and you fund it. You then have a credit card. And it just keeps spiralling. And in the end, the brakes have to be put on. You have to go, you know what, you can't keep borrowing. The level of lending and the level of borrowing has to come down. And sometimes that hurts.
But much of what's going on in economic activity now is built on borrowed money, so we can't just suddenly forget it all, can we?
You've got to slow it down, and then you've got to try and find a way to reverse it.
But I mean,
it.
If you're trying to slow that lending down, you're going to end up with an even bigger recession.
What you need to do is spend money directly into the economy to raise real wages. Real wages stagnated in the United States from 1973 onwards, so people were actually, in real terms, as poor or poorer than they were in 1973, and they made up the shortfall by borrowing. Mm. The old way the system used to run before deregulation and the neoliberal revolution was that the level of demand in the economy was managed by planned interventions by the government, and it was all based on having high and stable real wages so that people didn't have to borrow. And of course you people didn't buy houses because they lived in council houses.
But at that stage you'll start ending up with the government borrowing the money for you.
Yes, but the government...
And at the moment, I remember as a Conservative activist, we ran a campaign 2 years ago that said every person in this country, man, woman, child, owed £17,000. And within 6 months, we had to pull the campaign because it already hit £19,000. And then it was £22,000. And then I think with yesterday's bailout, we're now at £23,000, £24,000. And in the end, you seem to either be advocating that the state incurs the borrowing or the individual incurs the borrowing. Both of them need to accept there have to be limitations on lifestyle.
There is a limit. Obviously, there is a limit to how much the government can borrow, how much individuals can borrow. But I would point out that Britain has had a national debt since the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And that those kind of arguments were put out in 1815, that we couldn't afford this and we couldn't afford that. In actual fact, if the government spends the money wisely that they have borrowed, and of course the government doesn't have to borrow all of the money, it can actually make its own money. In North Dakota, there is a North Dakota bank owned by North Dakota, which was put in place in the 1890s, and that provides the money supply for North Dakota. There are alternatives to private banking. There always have been.
Now, many people realise that a lot of the problems with this started in the deregulation in the United States with their financial markets. I'd like to have a little listen now, if you both maybe comment afterwards, to an ex-Wall Street financial analyst, Max Keiser. Max Keiser has his own YouTube channel, and he was on BBC Radio 5 earlier on this week as well. So let's see what Max has to say about a meeting there was a couple of weeks ago of all the bankers in the US, and they had a kind of a big party to celebrate their industry.
Well, in one of America's fair cities, I believe it's Chicago, they've got a huge protest at the American Bankers Association award dinner. I think they're giving out awards this week for who ripped off the most people with collateralized debt obligations. They have an award for the most fakakta derivative instrument ever invented in the history of Wall Street. That's going out to the American Bankers Association dinner awards this week in Chicago. Let's play the video of these people out in the lobby. These are the people who got ripped off, of course, from the American Banking Association and their newfangled products and all of their quote-unquote financial engineering. Look at these peasants.
Wells Fargo is one of the top subprime lenders in America.
Oh yeah, Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is one of those banks in America. Its own biggest shareholder is Warren Buffett, who has the squeaky clean image of being Mr. Nice Guy, but he's actually a financial terrorist. Remember, he's the one who warned against the weapons of mass financial destruction. And of course, Wells Fargo, a bank that he's a big owner, is one of the biggest wielders
The irresponsible lending practices have led to thousands of foreclosures and vacant buildings in our communities. Wells Fargo is also guilty of targeting African Americans and Latinos with predatory subprime loans.
Ah, this poor woman. She lost all of her money. But, you know, this is what's it called? Oh, yeah, the showdown in Chicago at the American Bankers Association meeting slash gala dinner. I remember back in the 80s, they had the Predators Ball. Remember Drexel Burnham and Mike Milken? They celebrated all the money they stole in the 80s. This is just a 2009 version of it. It's not going to end. There'll be another one of these next year, and the year after that, the banks are never going to stop because there's no laws to stop them. Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, they're financial terrorists.
Financial terrorists. Well, I mean, it's very entertaining that Max Kaiser on YouTube. But Martin, is this really over the top, calling these people financial terrorists?
It's political rhetoric, isn't it? Let's face it, it's political rhetoric. But they certainly have made a mess. There's no doubt about that.
And what he's saying is there are actually no laws to stop them. Is that true?
Well, effectively, no. I mean, the money that's been given to the banks has not... there ought to be some quid pro quo, but there isn't really. And the reason that there isn't a quid pro quo is because the political class don't know what to ask them to do. They just presume that the banking system looked after itself while they worried about welfare reform. And then suddenly this squealing baby has landed in their lap, the banking system, and they don't know how to change its nappy. They've no idea what to do with it.
But you see, they do have shareholdings in some of the major banks now.
Who's,
so
who's they? You mean
the government?
Us,
the government.
Us, we
yeah,
do,
we
yes.
do. Yes, sorry. Yeah,
but
okay.
we just
cash them in.
Well, ultimately, we might be able to. This is what the idea is, that we put the money in the banks and eventually we'll be able to sell and make a profit, which is what the Swedes did in the 90s when they crashed their banking system through a neoliberal deregulation.
Yeah, but this kind of intervention has a habit of, we put the money in, we then expect to make a profit on it, but it just gets written down and written off.
Yes,
we've probably just given them that. I mean, I wasn't sure whether financial terrorist is the right word. I think more lemming, possibly. I mean, the only thing I can imagine would be worse would actually be an MP or a group of MPs holding a party and putting it on expenses as compared to the bankers funding a ball like that. I really do think they should have been advised by some fairly, I'm sure they pay for PR. It should be advised by someone said, for God's sake, don't do it.
But we have the British Bankers Association. I'm sure they have their dinners along similar lines.
They should.
Can I just make a comment about this? There's lots of small town banks in America. They've got a very decentralised system compared to ours. So I mentioned the Bank of North Dakota earlier, which just deals with North Dakota. There's actually quite a lot of private banks in the US which actually didn't touch any of this Wall Street nonsense. And they feel unfairly traduced. And I think they do have a bit of a point there. It's the big money centre banks in New York which have caused the mess. And they're, of course, too big to fail, so they're bailed out. But lots of smaller banks who are actually quite prudent are being wiped out by the recession. I think it's time we take a step back from this whole way of managing things and look at it in a different light. And if the Conservatives win the next election, the ball will be in their court to do that.
Yeah, so what will you be doing, Mark?
Well, I wish if I knew that answer, then I think I'd be on a higher pay grade. I mean, I think the banking sector does need to have some more regulation brought into it. I don't agree with being overly zealous on the regulation, because government has proven time and time again that when they try that, it just fails further down the line and causes bigger problems. You have to trust people to actually run their own kind of organisations, their own business, their own lives. But in this situation, they ran it wrong. And there has to be some kind of carrot and stick. They've had the carrot. It was a rather large one. It's going to cost us a lot of money for a long time. We're going to have to use the stick a bit, and I think we're going to have to control the way they do their banking.
Well, they still have the carrot in the way of bonuses, don't we? We were something like 20 billion
still
altogether.
Being paid.
I mean, yeah. I quite liked the approach Osborne came out with it last week. They said that actually, if you're going to give bonuses in shares, and you can't cash them in. So the long-term stability and the long-term profitability of the bank will reward your return. But don't give it out in itself. I think it was over £2,000 in cash. Because that way, the employee, and let's be fair, there is a difference between the people that are behind the desk at the branches and rather than those that were speculating, they will have a stake in making sure that bank is profitable long-term.
Finally, the Guardian is saying today the treatment isn't working, that this is going to be the last bit of quantitative easing we're going to have. So what happens if this doesn't sort things out? Martin, maybe you could answer that one.
Well, what next after the quantitative easing? There's an absolute danger, and I'm sure Mark will agree with me, there's a danger of a further crash. a further loss of confidence in the financial markets, which will lead, for example, the Chinese central bank is sitting there on a mountain of IOUs and wondering what on earth they're for. There was a leaked story run by Robert Fisk in The Independent. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago. He talked about he had sources in banking industry in Hong Kong that the Chinese were looking to try and dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency. The dollar took a knock immediately, 5% down, and then perhaps leading to your next item about Afghanistan, the Chinese foreign minister, it wasn't widely reported in our press, the Chinese foreign minister said sotto voce, he said, "We think it's about time you withdrew from Afghanistan." Have you just seen what's happened to the dollar there? You just lost 5% of its value. That's because we planted a story in the Hong Kong banking industry to make sure that you got the message.
I think a lot of this is the international banking sector itself relies a lot on trust. And it has to trust the governments that come in and that are actually incurring this debt to be able to pay it off in the long term. Because if they don't, then they stop lending. You start needing to sell gilts, as they are in Britain, at higher rates of interest that aren't quite as nice as the ones we're enjoying now, and your credit rating starts to suffer. Mm-hmm. And then it gets harder and harder. Because if you have a deficit built in, I mean, not including this $20 billion and everything else, if you have a deficit built into your budget projections year on year, you're incurring it year on year, and the international money markets have to trust you to, in the end, service it and repay it back. And there's no clear plan yet from this government.
Can I just make a final comment on this, which is, we don't necessarily have to borrow money from the private banking sector. I've said it twice, I'll repeat it for the third time. I used to be a teacher. The state can create its own money supply. People think that the state creates its own money supply. In actual fact, what it does is it subcontracts the creation of the money supply to the private banking system, which is what all the stuff about how to measure M3 was about in the 1980s, because it wasn't clear what money actually was, especially in the electronic age. It certainly isn't the cash in our pockets anymore. We've got to get back to a situation where the government creates money and doesn't lend it to the banking system to borrow it back to itself, but actually spends it directly into the economy to build the green industrial revolution, but which everybody wants.
Then you devalue the pound and you lead to greater borrowing.
Well, in that case, we have to raise taxes on the wealthy people who've done so well out of this deregulated market in the last 30 years.
I'm sure the economy will love it when all of them, and I do believe
most of those people don't spend that money. Yeah?
You do need a robust tax regime, and I'm not arguing with the 50%, but if you start taxing them to an overzealous point, they are just going to go elsewhere. We need those businesses to stay in Britain.
Well, on this point, the reason why the budget deficit was running up in the United States during the Reagan era was because of an economist called Arthur Laffer and the Arthur Laffer's curve, which is basically a normal distribution curve. And this is where this idea that if you have a tax rate over 50%, your tax rate goes down because less entrepreneurial activity takes place, people avoid taxes and so on. Now, all that was a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph. It had no empirical basis whatsoever. The highest rate of tax in the United States was 98% in 1952, when the Korean War was at its height, when the threat from communism was breathing down the neck of the American ruling class, and they thought they had to win the war in Korea. And at that stage, they had a 98% tax regime on the top earners. And nobody batted an eyelid. The economy trundled along, wages were high, people weren't in debt, and they won the Korean War, if that's what you want to call it. It was a draw in the end. But those, when national survival is at stake, the wealthy have to get their checkbooks out. That's what happened in 1940, and that's probably what's going to have to happen again.
OK, can we move on to Afghanistan now? Because it's been a big week over in Afghanistan, yeah. And particularly earlier this week, the tragic death of 5 British forces personnel shot by an Afghan policeman. Mark, what are your thoughts on the situation over in Afghanistan? And do you think, I don't know if you managed to listen to Gordon Brown's speech this morning, but are you convinced that he's put together a very good case for us staying there?
Well, I'm probably going to be very controversial, but I can understand why we are in Afghanistan. I never understood Iraq. But I think the problem is, at the moment, the government needs to decide whether they're going to just fight and win, or whether they're just fighting so they don't know how to stop. And I'm not convinced Brown knows. If he is going to fight and try and win, which I think at this stage is the only option, we need to make sure there is a stable government out there, because there was a link between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and people, I think, accept that. But at the moment, just trundling along, not quite sure what you're doing, where the soldiers aren't supplied to the level that they should have, it's not good for anyone. I mean, my brother's shipping out there next year, and my brother-in-law's just got back, so I know what it's like to sit at the end of the phone because I'm my brother's next of kin, waiting and looking at the phone call and any withheld number or number you don't know. But I understand why we're there. And I think the government needs to understand why we're there too, and it actually needs to start backing the soldiers out there. And one thing that I think has been good since the finish of the Iraq war has actually been the respect that's gone back to our soldiers. Because of this government's use and misuse of military power, I think, in Iraq, the soldiers took the blunt end. I mean, I know for a fact that my family members have been spat at for being soldiers, for going out and fighting, but I think that's starting to change. I think people do understand why we're in Afghanistan, but I think they need to see a clear goal and a clear exit strategy.
Now, this war has been going on for longer now than the Second World War, and it doesn't seem that there is any clear end in sight. So are you confident that we're going in the right direction?
Not if we're going to fight it the way we are fighting it.
So what changes? I mean, I know you're not necessarily a military commander, but what sort of changes would you like to see?
I can actually see the argument for putting more soldiers out there and for putting a push and a surge, I think was the American term that they used, and fighting to win and then get the soldiers out. We need to make sure that the Afghanistan army is trained as fast as possible to take over, and to make sure that we are doing the security and to make sure they are trained fast, we need a few more people on the ground.
Martin?
Do you want me to comment in general about the situation rather than...
Well, specifically on this killing of five soldiers by Afghan police.
The killing of the five soldiers reminded me very much of what happened in Vietnam, where the South Vietnamese army, which was being trained by the US, I remember reading a very good memoir of a top South Vietnamese intelligence officer. He was actually in charge of their intelligence operation in the whole of South Vietnam, apart from the fact that the Americans didn't realise that he was working for the North Vietnamese all along. And this was a huge problem. But there was a similar problem when the British were in Aden in the 1960s. In 1967, the Northumberland Fusiliers came back to base, which was being held by their Arab allies, which they'd trained. And, of course, the Arab allies, which they'd trained, were all actually working for the National Liberation Front. And they carried out an ambush on the Northumberland Fusiliers, killed 30-odd of them, because, you know, it was a complete surprise attack. And then Mad Mitch Hoare, who was the commander of the Black
what
Watch...
What a name.
Well, he was called Mitch Hoare, but he was known as Mad Mitch Hoare.
I didn't think he was christened that way.
No, right. But I mean, he then led the Black Watch specifically against his instructions. It was a Labour government at the time. Dennis Healey was the Foreign Secretary, and they said, "We're leaving Aden in 6 weeks. We're not going to go back into Salt City and retaliate for what's just happened here. We're getting out." But he disobeyed his orders from London, and he took the Black Watch into Salt City in Aden, where they carried out all kinds of atrocities. And many of the people who carried out those atrocities, which are war crimes in international terms, are still walking around drawing pensions today. And Mad Mitch Hoare, although he was never promoted inside the army, and he never got any further up the hierarchy, he wasn't disciplined either. Now, I believe and I understand that the British Armed Forces today have got a much better command structure, much more robust than that. But this is a fundamental problem. The Soviets had the same problem in Afghanistan, and if I can just... You know, there's an awful lot to say about this, but I'll just make one point, and then I'll hand over to Mark, is that Robert Gates, who's the current defence secretary in the United States, he's Obama's defence secretary, he was exactly the man who was responsible for arming, training and directing al-Qaeda with his friends in the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency in the 1980s. So we haven't just got continuity of policy here, we've got continuity of personnel. Robert Gates is, in fact, an Iran-Contra criminal who should have been prosecuted. But he wasn't prosecuted. Not only was he not prosecuted, he's still in charge. And these are the people who are saying we've got to fight on in Afghanistan. These are the people who armed and trained these people in the first place.
Okay. Right. I always love it when people go on about and say, oh, this is exactly what the Soviets had in the 80s. There is only slightly one difference to that, is that we actually do have Afghanistani allies out there, whereas the Soviets are pretty much fighting an entire country.
The vast
majority of people in Afghanistan don't want the Taliban back. I think you'll accept that.
I don't know. I don't accept that, actually. They've obviously got popular support in Helmand Province, in the particular place where
the British Army province always mentioned.
Well, yes, but the fact is that the Panchar Valley, where the British Army did the Operation Panther's Claw, there are 80,000 potential voters in that valley, of which only 150 turned up to the ballot box. You do when you've got a foreign occupation is what the Taliban is saying. We will participate in elections. They're already negotiating with Karzai behind the scenes. We all know that. That's what's going going to happen. In the end, just like Ireland or South Africa or everywhere else, the Taliban have to be brought into the political process and we have to get out by negotiating our way out. That's the way the Americans have got to leave Iraq as well. Don't leave it in a mess. Negotiate your way out.
And I think that I would agree with that. You do need to negotiate your way out, but you need to negotiate from position of strength.
Yes, but we're
and
losing.
You need to make sure that the Taliban are on the back foot when you bring them in, and you bring in the moderate Taliban. I'm sorry, but if you're having a go at whatever his name was, Gates, then I think we have to accept that the same source will work for the Taliban on that one. If they've been involved in atrocities, then they need to face trial.
Mark, just one thing on this. We keep hearing about the British Army have got to win hearts and minds. Do you think it's really possible for the British Army to be winning hearts and minds in Afghanistan?
Yes, I genuinely do. I think if there is if there's stability, and if stability comes along and people can start to see economic growth, then that will do it. But it's not going to be done through promises. It's going to have to be done through results.
Well, can I just say that it's quite clear that British public opinion has made up its mind that they don't want to fight in Afghanistan. I've been collecting signatures on petitions for Britain to withdraw from Afghanistan, and I have to tell you, we've got no problem at all in all parts of Bristol from all sections of the community. You get the occasional kill them all, we should drop nuclear bombs on them person, but they're not taken seriously by ordinary people, and they shouldn't be taken seriously. Most British people... The Taliban aren't stupid. They can read our opinion polls. They've got more popular support on the ground in Pashtunistan than we've got in this country. And I think the Americans have got a similar problem. Something like 60 to 70% of their people don't want to fight in Afghanistan. The Taliban can read that. It took them 10 years to defeat the Soviets. It's taken them about 10 years to defeat us because they're very, very good militarily. I think nobody in the British Army would disagree with that.
No, they are very good in the terrain they're fighting in. They're ideal fighters, is where they've trained.
Yes, well, they're the local boys, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the issue, I think, when it comes down to it, is that we do need to get out of Afghanistan, but we need to on our own terms. You can't simply go into a country and destroy its entire government structure, destroy the way it's been run for decades, and then pull out. And I think this government has just wasted so much time on not putting anything in place. There was no clear plan, and I think everyone accepts that. The same was with Iraq. We should have gone in with a clear goal, and we didn't. We sort of sketched it on the back of a post-it note when we were 2 or 3 years in, and there needs to be some kind of finality to it now.
Right. Let's leave Afghanistan for now. I'll probably be coming back there again and again in future weeks. But
sadly, yes.
Anyway,
I thought Bristol City Council had a foreign policy.
You're also an aide to an MEP, so you've got a wider remit.
Yeah, okay. Afghanistan's not in Europe.
No. Europe is what we're coming on to next, is it?
Yes, it certainly is. We're going to have a look at Mr. Cameron's U-turn this week over a referendum on Europe. Two things. This is Peter Hitchens, who's a notorious Eurosceptic in the Daily Mail. Two things were pitiful about the speech about Mr. Cameron. One was its content. Two was its generally low-key, excuse-making reception by all but a few media outlets. So do you think that the Conservative Party is always going to have this noose around its neck, Mark, over Europe? Because it doesn't seem that there's any kind of resolution, really. And we have this year after year after year, and almost before every general election, quite a fundamental problem at the heart of the Conservative policy over Europe.
Well, certainly in the last 20 years, yeah. I mean, first of all, I don't agree with the idea that Cameron actually had a U-turn of thing, and I think you probably expect me to say that. Cameron always said that we would have a referendum unless it was in force. And I wish we had a referendum. You know, we were promised one and we really should have had it, but it has now been ratified. And as the opposition, we're not in a position that we can say we can give a referendum on it. It is going to be law in the EU and it's going to be law in Britain by the time and if we take power in May. So you can't keep fighting the old battle and the same battle. In the end, you have to accept that result has happened and you've got to move on to the next. And I actually thought Cameron's response was very measured, and I do agree with it, that you pass the sovereignty bill, which talks about the supremacy of British law over EU law, and that's the same as it happens in Germany. You then pass the referendum bill that means any subsequent giving of power to Brussels has to be put before the people. And then he's carefully laid out where he would like to repatriate opt-outs, where he would like to repatriate powers in the next negotiations, because let's face it, Europe is about consensus politics. If they want things off Britain, then there are going to be some price tags attached to that. And I think the best opportunities for that will probably be the budget negotiations in a couple of years.
Well, I'm not in the Conservative Party, so why are you...
Well, I want to have your comments on what you think of the Conservative... I would call it a U-turn. I think the Conservatives were absolutely adamant. The Labour Party also were saying a very similar thing. Why is it that the British public haven't been given a vote over this Lisbon Treaty since it's handing so much of our lawmaking power over to Brussels?
I think the EU project, which was originally conceived by the French... civil service as a means of controlling markets has become a neoliberal project.
Do you mean by neoliberal?
Let me give you an example. Neelie Kroes, who is the competition commissioner at the EU, has overruled the British strategy on dealing with RBS and insisted that it must be broken up and that competition must reign. Now, leaving aside the arguments about whether we should have a competitive banking structure or, as I would argue, a public banking structure, Neelie Kroes is driving a neoliberal agenda that competition will somehow solve the problem. Now, I think that this has become enshrined in EU law and in EU attitudes. And I, as somebody from the left, I want to see more control over the economy by society rather than less. And the EU has become a vehicle, instead of for disciplining market, the EU has become a vehicle for forcing markets open and forcing local governments and smaller communities to fit in with this market ideology. And I don't like that.
Every time the state, though, has tried to monitor the economy, it has ended in disaster in the long run. So I don't agree with that model. And I have to reiterate, I don't agree that Cameron's actually done a U-turn on this. Cameron always, his line always was that if the Lisbon Treaty is not in force, then we will give you a referendum. If it is in force, then we won't let matters rest. And that was his quote. So it's not a U-turn. It is now in force. We should have had a referendum on it. We were promised it by all three parties. We did our best. The early day motion went to Parliament to try and demand a referendum, and Labour and the Lib Dems both voted against it.
But this isn't democracy, is it? Because surely in a situation like this where we're handing over lawmaking power away from Westminster and Parliament to Brussels, surely the British people should in some way be consulted.
When you say handing law over, we've handed it. It is now gone. That treaty, unfortunately, was signed. President Klaus of the Czech Republic couldn't hold on any longer. He would have to hold on, another 29 weeks, I think, before a potential general election, and he faced enormous pressure within and without his country. I think the guy needs a medal, to be honest. The people should have been consulted, and I think the referendum act that Cameron proposes will mean that you can't have it again. That's why Ireland had a vote. Admittedly, they ignored the first vote and gave him a second one, so maybe that's too much democracy.
You've got to vote again and again until you get it right.
So you give the right answer. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But that they had the vote initially because they had a referendum act that meant that the people had to vote on it.
So do the Conservatives have a plan B to distance themselves from Europe, tear the treaty up?
Well, the Lisbon Treaty. No, yeah. The Lisbon Treaty is in force. What we want to bring back is some of the powers that it gives is back to Britain. And again, that's going to have to be little by little. And it's not going to happen the first day we're in power. Let's be honest about it. The priority of a Conservative government coming in is going to be the deficit. It is that large. But Europe has got to be there as well.
One of the things that concerns me always about the European Union is the failure to pass the budgets year after year in Europe. I mean, surely we can't be handing over our sovereignty to somebody that hasn't actually put the book straight.
Well, no, they haven't signed off on the budgets for, I think, 14 years, which I think is about the same time that actually the Works and Pensions Department hasn't been signed off in Britain. That also doesn't get in the press that much. But yeah, it does need to be.
Anyway, we're joined now by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina.
Hello.
And what were you going to be talking? You've got a report for us this week. What's it about?
Oh, yes. It's a report. Last week, Bristol City Council decided to adopt a plan to make Bristol one of the top 20 European cities by 2020. The Bristol 2020 plan is a 10-year strategy for the Bristol Partnership, seeking to improve the city during the next decade. The Bristol Partnership is a group of organizations including the City Council, the Police and the National Health Service. The ambitious plan promises to provide employment opportunities through the city, help elderly and disabled people become more active, reduce teenager pregnancy, prevent ill health, increase walking and cycling, reduce energy use, provide more affordable housing and reduce crime. To make the top 20, Bristol will have to improve in four categories that are used to measure sustainability, quality of life and achievement among European cities. It will need to reduce inequalities in health and wealth, become more environmentally friendly, improve life for the city's minorities and raise the aspiration of young people. Bristol apparently came 34th in the last survey of European cities' income in 2005, with Frankfurt, Karlsruhe in Germany and Paris the top three. But how real is this? Is this just some plan that we all have paid to distinct to gather dust on a shelf? It might be said that Bristol has a poor education record, one of the worst in the country. For example, in a leaked table of such test results from 2008, the city of Bristol came 149th out of 150, making the London Board of Hockey perhaps fear for its position at the bottom of the table that it had held for the previous 6 years. Poor planning, think of the traffic chaos and cobbles in the city centre, a poor and expensive public transport system and infrastructure, socially deprived areas, a mediocre record of hospital service, the lack of large concert and sports facilities, a lack of provision for Bristol youth services. We all would be happier in a better city and in a better world, but is this plan nothing more than empty aspiration without measurability? Perhaps the council should concentrate on delivering their core services.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Mark, let's just get your response to that. Is this a report which is just going to gather dust, do you think?
No, I mean, I can see where you would think that. I think you need to have an aspiration for a city. It needs to have a goal. And becoming one of the top 20 cities by 2020 is a goal. Whether we achieve it or not, to be honest, I think it's almost by the by. We have to have something to strive to. I mean, was it saying, I mean, all your dreams come true but one, because you've always got to have something to aim for. I think we should aim for it. And certainly the things that we have to complete along the way are worth achieving in their own right. Putting them together as part of a package seems to add a greater degree of a goal, should we say, for what we're going for. I mean, education does need improvement.
Yeah, I mean, we were hearing there that Bristol is 149 out of 150 cities in the education stakes. What is it you think that's been the problem with? Because we are notorious for having a bad state education system. What's behind that?
I think if we knew, we wouldn't have the problem. I think it's also sort of got into a self-defeating circle for the moment. I think that is changing. We are making improvements, and I will admit to education not being my strongest point. But the private sector in Bristol is strong, and it takes out an awful lot of the city's children, up to a third, I think, certainly in some places. And that third do very well in the private school. I think we need to get them back in. We need to encourage them back into the public sector and get them working on it. And to be honest, I think the way to do that is actually have streaming by ability in schools so that no one gets left behind and no one is held back.
Martin, what are your thoughts about the idea of aiming to be one of the top 20 cities in Europe?
Well, I think I agree with Mark that there's nothing wrong with having aspirations. And I think the vehicle...
We agreed. Did you notice that?
Yes. Well, I think the existence of the partnership is important as well, because that creates continuity in policy. over a long period. So it's not just a football kicked around by whoever takes control of the council. And there's a general consensus about the sort of things that we'd like to see in Bristol. I was interested to hear Mark say that we'd like to see more kids out of the private schools and into the public sector. That's not a normal Conservative position, it has to be said, but it's also something which...
Now we're going back to stereotypes at this point.
I think it's interesting that the thinking is starting to... We need to laterally think if we're going to resolve these problems. I think one thing I would say to all... I mean, this is a great school that we're sitting in now, the City Academy. I'm not very much in favour of the City Academy programme. You know, my father was a head teacher in inner city Liverpool. I'm from Widnes originally.
I won't hold it against you, it's all right. No.
It's okay. Well, we're. I'm a Woolly Back, and you're a Scouser. Widnes Rugby League is where we're coming from. Anyway, this isn't a sports programme, but I think my father took early retirement as a head teacher in the 1980s when the Conservatives were in power, because he said this whole idea of pitting schools in a local area against each other in a competitive way is poison. It's logical for the private sector. You know, Clifton College is competing with Harrow or whatever, but in the public sector, it just doesn't work. You need to provide a good school in every neighbourhood, and you've got to have that aspiration. And then you can only do that by having, you know, an overall plan of what you want to do. And can I just say to all of the very dedicated teachers and all the kids out there in Bristol who might be listening to this, if you have a league table of 150 schools, somebody's got to be bottom, and that doesn't mean you're rubbish, it just means you're bottom. And I think we've got to get away from this idea that, you know, you're the bottom of the class and you must be terrible. There's lots of good work that goes on in Bristol schools, and teachers and pupils need to be praised a bit more, and we need to, you know, that's what good teachers do. They don't bully, they praise.
I mean, I agree. I don't agree with the idea of league tables. I do think you do need competition, but there should be competition like within classes and, you know, striving against your colleagues. I don't like league tables as a rule.
Well, the obvious comment here is that many of the worst performing schools are simply a catchment area is in a very deprived area. So, I mean, that's almost what you would expect in that kind of area.
And also, it was your.
No, it's what we've come to expect. It's not what we should accept in that area.
Can I just say, I mean, I'm glad to hear that you're against league tables, because, of course, it was the Conservative government that brought them in, and our Labour government, which continued to push this very reactionary education agenda. Education isn't just about passing exams, it's bringing people up to be good citizens, to care for their neighbours. So all of these soft skills are not soft at all. They're what makes life livable and bearable. And it's great that we've got some kids that are achieving loads and loads academically, but there's other kids who achieve more on the football field or on stage. I mean, every child is capable of doing things. We should be finding out what they can do, not punishing them for the things that they can't do.
I think the slight twist on that is I think every child should be taught, you know, the basics, you know, talking your sciences, your English, your maths and all the rest of it. But there needs to be greater encouragement, I think, for vocational. And that has happened. I mean, I'm not going to do Labour down on this one. That has happened. People are starting to come forward. And if you're better with your hands, then you do courses that are better in that regard. And I think that I am happy with that. And the interesting thing is, I think when it comes to education on the council, it's I think the one political football, I think you called it earlier on, which actually doesn't get kicked around all that much. We may object to certain schools opening, closing and things like that, but invariably it's actually about resources rather than trying to score points off each other over the state of education. Because this is one where I think the city and councillors of any group have to come together and really work at it. And I think they are, in fact.
Okay, next story. Bristol City Stadium approved. Now, Mark, you're a Conservative councillor, a planning committee. This was one of your babies, wasn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it was my baby. I sat on the delivery, shall we say.
Yeah, but so what we've got here is a situation where Bristol City is being given a site which is essentially a greenfield site, a bit of...
most of it is green belt
land. And that the thing is, I think that most people who are questioning this decision, that sort of agricultural land is extremely cheap. Giving them planning permission to build on there, suddenly that land then becomes worth millions of pounds an acre. And also, the people who are living around that area are blighted. So can you just answer some of those concerns?
Yeah, I mean... This is always one of the tricky ones, and I actually don't normally sit on this planning committee, so I was delighted to be subbed onto such a controversial one. The green belt itself, whenever you weigh up if someone's going to be built on the green belt, and two-thirds of the site were at least, you need to weigh up the level of harm done to the benefit you'll gain from it. And it can't be an on-balance, which is what came out at the meeting. You can't be 50-50, not sure, but probably leaning. There has to be a clear benefit. Now, on part of the site, which is the bit where the stadium is going to go on and the bit where the hotel and restaurant's going on, we agreed that the benefits outweighed the harm in that special case. We didn't agree, though, in the other part of the site, it's about a third of the total area, that the benefits outweighed the harm. Because the wildlife very much is concentrated on the southern tip, I think it was called the Southland site. And so we actually turned down the housing on that site. So with the marsh improvements, the wetlands improvements that's been proposed, and the fact that we don't want that site built on, we've preserved part of the green belt, but our belief was that there were no other but suitable sites that could be easily developed. And people have differing opinions, but this whole planning process went through 14 alternative sites. So we granted permission on that one site.
So why doesn't Bristol City Football Club have to buy land at an expensive price like everyone else? How come they can buy this cheap agricultural land and build on there?
Well, where would you put the stadium? I think it's the flip side on that. The land itself, I mean, we are talking, it's not far from their existing stadium. It is, in fact, just down the road. So they're still within virtually the same community. The land that they were given the Moorland allotments, which was worth about $5 million. I wasn't thrilled by that, I have to say, because I think in the end the club really should be self-supporting. But if we, and this is, and me outside of my planning hat at this point, because it can't be a condition of planning, I was concerned at the level of subsidy that they are receiving, because we did waive £7.5 million worth of 106 money.
No, just to explain that 106
money.
106
money basically is any. Sorry, I need talking to the mic. Any large scale development, or in fact any development, has strings attached to it, where some money is then given to the council for the benefit of the community. Now we've taken. Okay, I'll give you an example from Henbury. There's a block of flats built there which gave £66,000 for improving youth and sports facilities in Henbury. So something similar. And this level, we actually waived £7.5 million worth of 106 money and gave them land worth £5 million. And if the bid is successful, I think the cabinet agreed that they'd give another £8 million to expand the stadium. It's a phenomenal level of subsidy, and I've got to say I'm not particularly thrilled by that, but you have to look at the planning reasons themselves. And if the land wasn't given and the 106 wasn't waived, there would be no stadium. Now, we just heard today about the 2020, you know, be one of the top 20 cities by 2020. And one of the aspirations there was that we need a city with some kind of large venue stadium. Well, this is it. And unfortunately, parts of it hurt. And I can only apologise to the people around there that we made that decision. But I do think it was the right one.
Well, I mean, I haven't got a lot to say about this. Obviously, it's a decision that that Mark has looked into in a lot more detail than I have. Just coming back to what he was saying at the very beginning of the show about planning law, people don't realise that most of the time you're not actually empowered to block anything as long as there's no good reason to do so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a free market bias in it, you know, that entrepreneurs and developers do get you know, there isn't actually anything that controls them. Obviously in this case, because of the Greenbelt land, that's you know, there's a lot more political input. I was fascinated to hear how much public money is going into this.
Yeah.
And we talk about the free market, but you know, Bristol City is effectively being subsidised by the Bristol taxpayer, and people listening to this programme will ponder about how much of their taxes they want to spend on Bristol City, especially if they're Rovers fans.
Well, what about the knock-on effect here? Because if this stadium is built, it's going to be big changes in and around Southville. So we've already got the supermarket, quite a few supermarkets around that area. Do you think that this is, I mean, this is part of what you've been looking at?
Yeah.
Whether or not it's a good idea, I mean, to have a new supermarket in Bedminster?
The thing with the stadium is that we are minded to approve, because first of all, it has to come back to the committee again, because there were some things we weren't happy about. that needs lighting mitigation because there were some serious issues there. I'm using all the jargon here, so I do apologise. And it needs some transport works done.
This is the idea of floodlights suddenly appearing out in a sort of small rural community.
Red floodlights. Yeah. Let's begin. I proposed blue for Everton, but apparently that's not allowed. And it needs some transport work done because the infrastructure levels weren't right around it and there are concerns about parking. So it's got to come back. Otherwise, it can still be refused. And it also has to be signed off by the Secretary of State. Because you're building on Greenbelt, the final say is with them. Although, invariably, if the city has looked at it and it looks like it's a fair democratic process and they've done their homework, he'll go with it. But yeah, the supermarket, that's an entirely different planning requirement, and that's going to be coming, I think, in January.
Well, it's nearly time for the Sky News at 6, Mark. So thank you very much for your time here on Friday Drive Time. Next week's guest is controversial ex-oil worker Ian Crane, who's the organiser of next weekend's Alternative View Conference at Bristol's Thistle Hotel. Stay with us if you can, though, because Billy Quain will be here after the news, we hope, with his Friday evening guide to what's on for free around and about town this weekend. And Marina Morris has been out on the streets finding out what you think about happiness, whether you managed to stay happy through the financial crisis and how. Also, after the news, we take a close look at the work of American filmmaker Alan Frankovich. His films in the 1980s and for the BBC Time Watch series are about political warfare against America's European allies by the US Central Intelligence Agency and suggest the CIA have taken a secret role in terrorist atrocities, treading a fine line between infiltrating terror groups and controlling them. See you after the news.